Welcome back, everyone. This is Ryan Selkis. You're listening to another episode of Messari's Unqualified Opinions, where each week I discuss key industry trends with crypto's top investors, builders, and thinkers. Just a reminder, Messari is much more than a podcast company. So if you're an industry professional or crypto investor, head over to Messari.io and check out Messari Pro, our crypto toolkit that offers best-in-class research, advanced screening, and charting tools to keep you ahead of the investing curve, plus a new enterprise alerts tool. We're also hosting the industry's largest virtual event, the Mainnet, this June 1st through 3rd, with over 50 hours of programming, 100 confirmed speakers, and virtual networking that's so seamless, you'll feel like you're actually there. 50% of the profits are heading to COVID relief, so go reserve your spot today at mainnet.events. That's Messari.io for pro research and tools, and mainnet.events for the best virtual event you'll attend this year. With that, strap in for another episode. Going to be a good one. This episode of the podcast brought to you by Luca. Save money this tax season with Luca Tax, the only time-tested crypto tax software. Luca has listened to your feedback and now lets you calculate capital gains and losses, seeing the results using three different accounting methods side by side, all for free. You only pay if you want to see their detailed tax reports and submit your forms using their software. Luca supports unlimited transaction downloads from all major exchanges and wallets and helps you optimize your tax reporting so you can max out this year's refunds or minimize how much you have to pay. Luca wants to help Messari's Unqualified Opinions listeners save even more this year. So use promo code MESSARITAX and you'll get a discount. Much more importantly, you'll do your taxes correctly and stay out of jail. Download Luca Tax at Luca with two Ks, tax.com, and save money this tax season. This episode is brought to you by Bitstamp, the original crypto exchange. 2011 is a long time. This is their third Bitcoin halving, and Bitstamp has been the preferred exchange for serious traders and investors all along the way. 4 million customers, including top financial institutions worldwide, use Bitstamp. Check them out because they've got some serious professional-grade trading technology, including a matching engine from NASDAQ, some of the best APIs in the industry, and TradeView, their advanced trading interface, includes live charting and deep analytical tools that are available on web and mobile. Bitstamp also delivers unmatched customer service, no robots, real live people around the clock via phone, email, and social media if you have issues, but you won't. Join over 4 million traders, download the Bitstamp app from the App Store and Google Play, or visit bitstamp.net/pro to get started. That's bitstamp.net/pro, and they're hooking you up with a discount for Messari Pro as well using promo code Bitstamp. This episode of the podcast brought to you by Crypto.com. We know times are tough. That's why Crypto.com is introducing three different measures to help its community with their new Crypto.com app and credit card. First, they're waiving 3.5% credit card fee on all crypto purchases in the next 3 months. They're also offering 10% back when you use the MCO Visa card on food and grocery shopping. And as always, you can buy gift cards on the Crypto.com app for merchants like Whole Foods, Safeway, Burger King, and more, with 20% back on food and an additional 10% back on groceries. So download the Crypto.com app today.
This podcast is presented by Blockworks Group, one of the top blockchain events and media production companies I've worked with. For exclusive content and events that could help you with insight into the crypto and blockchain space, check them out at blockworksgroup.io and you will not be disappointed.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to Messari's Unqualified Opinions. I'm Ryan Selkis at 2BitIdiot on Twitter, live from the Citadel with another glorious recording with another Citadel member. Different undisclosed location, but we just found out we're actually not too far away from each other. For OPSEC purposes, I will not disclose either of our states, but I'm talking today with Joe LaLuz, who's the CEO and co-founder of Bison Trails. We're going to talk all things crypto infrastructure. We're going to talk about which code bases are rat nests and which of his customers actually have a chance. I'm kidding only a little bit because we do want this to be entertaining. But Joe, you know, we're going to cover a lot of territory. You and I are kindred spirits in the sense that we are both picks and shovels providers in the Wild West. Tell me a little bit about your origin story within crypto, just to kind of level set with everybody, and then how you came to Bison Trails and the great named Bison Trails, which is one of the few companies like Messari that omitted the words bit, block, chain, crypto from our names.
Yeah, we were.
Looking, I think it's important.
Yeah, we were looking for a negative. What's the equivalent of a negative bump in valuation? If you omit blockchain and you omit bit, I believe that brings your valuation down. The same way as if you add it, right? You can.
I think. I think in bull markets, that's true. I think bear markets is probably the opposite.
Appreciate the, hey, first off, super happy to be here. Thank you for not disclosing my location, even though we talked a little bit about it before we got recording. I appreciate that. And really appreciate the kind words about the name. It's actually, you mentioned we're both in the sort of picks and shovels business, in the Wild West. The name Bison Trails is actually a hat tip to that. So, great segue into a little quick, origin story into my sort of foray and background into crypto. I actually like to say that my origin story for crypto is kind of boring, because the truth is it's a little bit boring. It's not like some crazy moment. It's just my co-founder and I are both technical and we're just huge nerds. We got involved in the crypto space pretty early on, but not as investors or not as builders or not as, people that are clairvoyant and can see the future, just because we saw this really crazy, decentralized concept and this new concept of finance and money. And we were crazy intrigued by the technology behind it. And so, one of the first times I ever heard about Bitcoin was there was this engineer that was working on our team at a different company, a previous company. And after he had left, we had found these long running processes on the servers that he was managing. He was an infrastructure engineer. And it turns out they were Bitcoin miners. At the time, I had no idea what it was. We found out and we're like, what is this Bitcoin thing? This was, probably around 2011 or 12. And so that was kind of my first experience with it. Ever since then, I was very intrigued by the movement, the space, the combination and sort of cross-section of deep technology and cryptography with financial and economic behavior and social behavior and social economics. Super, super interested, super interesting topic to me. From there, I sort of made crypto and blockchains a hobby. And so I spent a lot of time reading, following along projects, doing things like, angel investing in new projects and new protocols. And I mean, if you want to call it angel investing, whether that's in time or money or buying new assets and using all the weird experimental technology. And then in around 2016, my longtime co-founder and I, we'd built a few companies in the past, decided we were going to work on something new. And we could not get away from this idea that blockchains and transfer value networks and crypto was going to be the future of technology. It was an inevitability that we wanted to be a part of. Mm-hmm. There was a whole bunch of reasons why that was. And, I'll save like a 3-year sort of exploration story. We decided we wanted to sort of build a few different projects in the space. And one of the projects we built was we actually started looking at really early infrastructure in the blockchain space, which mostly consisted of proof of work mining. And we built a proof of work mine in the Pacific Northwest. And the way we went about that was actually driving through the, random middle parts of the country and getting on, little planes and like Southwest flights to the middle of nowhere and looking for spaces and finding really inexpensive power. And so when we were naming Bison Trails, it was a sort of hat tip to this experience of kind of traveling from the East, because we're based out of New York, through the country to the West during this like Wild West period of like exploration of crypto. And bison are really interesting animals. And during the gold rush, they actually paved these trails that pioneers would follow across the country. And so there's a sort of a combination there between what we're trying to do with infrastructure and helping pave the path forward for a lot of new pioneers in the crypto space.
it's a brilliant kind of double whammy, and I love the name. Some people know, because I've mentioned it before, others don't know the origin around, Masari, which is, it's similar, right? First of all, it kind of sounds cool. Sounds like Ferrari. but it's basically named after the Italian merchants that invented double entry bookkeeping, right?
That's awesome.
So our whole push on transparency and metrics and everything, is the crypto revolution, and triple entry bookkeeping going to be as revolutionary? We think so. And it kind of speaks to the data side. So, I think, and I don't take credit for that, by the way. That was our first hire. I shouldn't even admit to what the working name was, which we knew was going to be a placeholder, but let's just say Masari was an upgrade. So, you know, you guys are in a unique position because you're working with Ethereum and all of its friends, right? As we call it here, ETH and ETH killers. But the other the other projects, now that we're in a bear market, don't like saying that. In a bull market, they're perfectly content. You know, out of the projects that you're working with, because there's about I think about like 25 now between kind of live and testnet. What are some of the top things that you look for as you vet a protocol team, and whether you should spend time supporting them? Is it just kind of common sense? Hey, there's been a certain amount of venture raised, and we kind of know and like the team, and they've got a track record. Or kind of what's the method behind the madness for operationalizing support for some of these, you know, emerging assets, the testnets even, which you guys are far ahead of?
Yeah. So great question. One thing I'd just like to clarify is that using the word vetting, because I think it sets the wrong tone or the wrong, and not deliberately, but, you know, sets the wrong expectation for how we work with protocol teams. The way that we work with them is much more collaborative. It started way more organically, and has become even more collaborative over time. And so really early on, it was just my co-founder and I spending time in where the developers, the core developers, the open source developers of these different protocols were. So if that's a Discord or a Riot chat or a Slack channel or some forum. And it was really mostly in trying to explore what they were working on, what they were doing. We don't really necessarily vet projects, although ultimately that is kind of what does happen, because we have to decide where we're going to spend our time, and time being, you know, one of the most valuable resources that we have. So to answer your question more pointedly, it really does come down to understanding the mission and vision of the project itself. And then, like you said in the intro, spending some time in the code, understanding what the team is capable of, what's the pace of innovation, what are they trying to achieve, it's sort of an importance that we have as a very technical team. So, you know, Bison Trails is mostly an engineering organization, and we do spend a lot of time doing what we would consider some pretty unscalable work, in a sense that, you know, we're deep in the communities and deep in the code, and often making either suggestions to open source projects, or even, you know, committing code ourselves, or involved in things like governance procedures, councils, those kinds of things to help govern different projects. And so, you know, ultimately, what we're trying to do is, like you said, Ethereum and its friends, Ethereum killers or Ethereum replacers or Ethereum complements. I don't think we comment on whether or not that's true. It's more like, yeah, we want to help a lot of these different protocols succeed and deploy and orchestrate and launch. For us as a company, our mission is to, enable access to these different blockchains, and we succeed when many of these other blockchains succeed as well. So it really ends up being like understanding what their mission is, what they're trying to do. Do we as a technical team believe that what they're trying to do is possible? And then are they actually trying to achieve that goal? You know, are they actually putting the rubber to the road, so to speak? Are they committing code? Are they working on solving these problems? And you'd be surprised in the crypto space, if you actually look at the GitHubs of hundreds of these projects, different crypto projects, there's zero activity, or there's one person that's committed, you know, one code change in the last like 6 months, and you're like, wow, this is actually a pretty popular project, popular from a media perspective or popular from a community perspective, but like no one's really working on it. It's a little bit disheartening or a little bit discouraging. And so I would say that that'd be like a major criteria for us, is like paying attention to where engineers are spending their time and their efforts.
Yep. The quick and dirty way to monitor that is just to look at the GitHub repo and kind of see the presence at developer conferences, and you know, there's a little bit of common sense involved. You're talking about a number of different types of blockchains as well, and I think your support extends not just to the public permissionless chains, but layer two chains, more permissioned implementations like Libra, which just recently made that switch. Where do you generally think your efforts are going to triangulate, you know, going forward? Will it continue to be on public, or do you think that there is a world where managing permissioned blockchains for enterprises or you know, for other, you know, central banks that might ask, that becomes as big or bigger than the permissionless set right now, with Libra probably being right on that borderline?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good question, because I think, like, we've been very careful to not explicitly say we only support permissionless blockchains, or we only support permissioned chains, or we're an enterprise blockchain company. And that's because I actually think it's maybe a mischaracterization of our desired efforts. You know, it's really, we want to help support the ecosystem, and we built the company in this, in the sort of shadow of this idea that the infrastructure in the space is incredibly immature. And that's true for enterprise blockchains. It's true for permissioned blockchains. It's true for permissionless blockchains. I will say that as a company and as a founding team, we have a soft spot for permissionless networks, for censorship resistance, for some of the you know, crypto fundamentals that are really interesting and you know, what I think still incredibly experimental. And so we love working on permissionless chains, and we love working on these different projects. I would say that, like, you know, the majority of our efforts are going to probably continue to be where most of the developers are focusing, because I think, like, that's where the interesting things are happening, you know, and we're seeing more and more attempts at permissioned or sort of like closed networks, and things like Libra, for instance, are a really interesting opportunity for us, not because it's permissioned or permissionless, but because of the potential reach that a project like Libra has for the entire crypto space. And then you have something like, you know, Celo or Near or Solana or, you know, any of the other Ethereum friends or Ethereum killers, as you would say. And they have really great developer communities as well. And so it's, you know, I kind of feel like we're in a position where we can help support these different ecosystems in a similar way without making a judgment call as to whether one is better or worse. We'll sort of let the market decide that. We'll also let folks that have very, very, very strict, like, crypto fundamental opinions about that. I don't think there's anything wrong with those opinions. It's more for us, like, how do we solve this infrastructure problem and not necessarily pick, like, an opinion that's the right one, that's the winning one.
Mm-hmm. Just a point of clarification. Are you, all of the chains that you currently support and have on the roadmap are staking chains, correct?
So we this is something, we've been pretty quiet about. Maybe I'll get in trouble from my team for even mentioning this. So our infrastructure platform is specifically designed for staking chains, for proof of stake networks. And the idea there is that proof of stake networks, because of the nature of consensus in those networks and the way that the technology works, you need incredibly high availability, security, redundancy, and the kinds of things that you would want from a really robust infrastructure platform. So we've set the bar super high for the technology that we run and the platform that we run. What that means is that we can actually run infrastructure on networks that have maybe a lower bar because of a slightly different requirement set. So things like Bitcoin or Ethereum that are not proof of stake, or Zcash, or really just ways for folks to interact with the chain itself, but not create blocks or validate or produce blocks. And we do run infrastructure on those networks as well. Similarly, things like Libra, which isn't a proof of stake network, it's you could arguably say is a proof of authority network, because no one is actually staking or delegating digital assets behind a validation or a block production node. We support proof of authority networks as well, in that they have a similar bar from a security, redundancy, and availability perspective, they just have a different mechanic for how trust is built or earned in that network. And so we support proof of stake networks, pretty much mostly proof of stake networks. And we also support things like proof of authority networks. as a point of clarification. And then we also help a lot of, you know, large scale custodians, exchanges, asset managers, funds that want to run highly available, secure private nodes in all of these different blockchain networks, create reliable read and write access to the network.
So, you know, I think the early days for staking networks are a mixed bag. Your ultimate pricing, are you running any pools, or are you just providing the infrastructure for folks that want to run pools and you know, maybe working with the foundations on their own redundancies today?
So we mostly work with, so we don't really, I like the concept of pooling is right. Although we don't really call them that. We mostly help support folks that want to participate themselves in the networks. So folks that want to, you know, quote unquote, run their own pools, run their own validators in the network. What that means is that if, you know, Messari wanted to run a Cosmos validator, Messari could use Bison Trails' platform to run a Messari Cosmos validator, as opposed to if you were just holding Cosmos or Atoms and you wanted to delegate those, you could probably delegate them to anybody. And the idea here is that you could put, we are enabling a company like Messari or a fund or an asset manager or a custodian or exchange to participate themselves in the network and participate in things like governance and voting and staking and helping secure the network. And so that's our bread and butter. That being said, we do generally run a Bison Trails node in every network that we support on our platform. It's a way for us to dog food our own product. It's a way for us to support folks that are maybe, you know, smaller holders in the network, but they still want to use Bison Trails because we have a great reputation for security and infrastructure. So, you know, if Joe LaLuz, for instance, or, you know, if Ryan wanted to, you know, stake his 45 Atoms on the Cosmos network, he probably wouldn't run a Cosmos validator. He would most likely delegate to someone else. And so Ryan could still delegate to a Bison Trails node. So the idea is we're kind of behind the scenes, but we also like to make sure that we're participating in the network as a good community member.
When are you going to set up a sidecar fund? It seems like a no-brainer. So I'm serious, right? Like, you know, if you have all the infrastructure set up and you have a node for each, you know, the 2-in-20 model works like a charm here and it's on autopilot just to kind of allocate on a market cap basis, no?
Yeah. So I wish what you just said about it's on autopilot to allocate on a market cap basis was true. I actually think that being a fund administrator and an investor is a very different job than being an infrastructure provider. And so what we like to do is partner with really great funds as opposed to creating a sidecar fund. So we work with really great funds. We work with some of the best in the world. And we help power their participation in those networks as opposed to building a fund ourselves.
Instead of 2-in-20, you're very you're very satisfied with 5 or 10, I'm sure.
it's just a different core. It's a different core competency, completely different core competency. And I think the folks that we partner with, that we work really closely with, that are our customers, know that, and they're excited to work with us. And we're really excited to work with some of the best folks in the space. So I actually think you're highlighting one of the bigger problems in the crypto space is that a lot of people try to do everything. And truly that's something that we are trying to stay away from. So it's like, we don't want to be a fund. We don't want to be an investor. We're 100% non-custodial. So we don't take custody of assets. Mm-hmm. We want to be an infrastructure provider and that's what we do because we do it well.
Well, you know, the other thing that, aside from just focusing, the other thing that really helps with is, actually getting closer to true decentralization, not just in name, but in practice, particularly for staking networks, which are at most risk. You can have centralization of mining in Bitcoin because there's always going to be these competitive pressures to, you know, mine the next block. But if you own a staking network, you're entrenched, right? You are now part of the new rentier class. Yep. So you, being in the position that you are, have a pretty good look at actual decentralization versus decentralization theater. Not necessarily like shitting on any projects that might have different balances of stakeholders, but how do you think about network health and how it evolves over time based on where resources are pooled in? Do you ultimately become a point of centralization yourselves at some point, working with all these funds in terms of critical infrastructure? Because as many redundancies as you have, if there's an outage or there's a regulatory regime that says, we don't like this blockchain, and then they trace it back, the support back to you, well, that could create a pretty meaningful problem for the network itself. So there's like three or four different things to unpack there, but I'm curious how you kind of map out security concerns when it comes to decentralization.
Yeah, I think, so it's a great question, and it's one of the things that traces all the way down to the company's DNA and the ethos of myself and my co-founder and what we actually, quite frankly, care about, what we give a shit about, and that's the truth. So there's two ways that we've generally been thinking about it. The first is that if we can, and this is something we're still constantly working on, we build our platform in a way that helps with distribution and decentralization. And it's something that we're constantly working on. And that comes from a technology standpoint. So we do things like we're 100% multi-cloud, we're multi-zone and multi-region. The platform we build is automated and redundant in the sense that it can recover itself. And if there's an outage on a cloud provider and on the East Coast, because there's a disaster, we can easily move to a different cloud provider or a different zone or different region without causing blips in the network. Similarly, like you said, because we're at a very low level in the network itself, we have a really good understanding of the fact that, you know, maybe like 70% of the network is running on Amazon AWS East and no one else knows. They don't realize. And so we do take a sort of like good actor approach to that, where if we realize these things are happening, we will help distribute nodes across different parts of the world and different parts of different cloud providers and different zones and different regions. And that entirely is, you know, that's one of those things that is baked into our company DNA, is not necessarily verifiable, and is something that, like, you know, our customers trust and our reputation and brand relies on, but is something that we are working towards building technology to help open that up and show that that's true and show those things that are more verifiable. So that's the first thing.
This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Luca. Save money this tax season with Luca Tax, the only time-tested crypto tax software. Luca has listened to your feedback and now lets you calculate capital gains and losses, seeing the results using three different accounting methods side by side, all for free. You only pay if you want to see their detailed tax reports and submit your forms using their software. Luca supports unlimited transaction downloads from all major exchanges and wallets and helps you optimize your tax reporting so you can max out this year's refunds or minimize how much you have to pay. Luca wants to help Messari's Unqualified Opinions listeners save even more this year. So use promo code MESARITAX and you'll get a discount. Much more importantly, you'll do your taxes correctly and stay out of jail. Download Luca Tax at Luca with two Ks tax.com and save money this tax season. Thanks to our sponsor, Bitstamp, for making this special halving series possible. Bitstamp's the original global crypto exchange. We're proud to be celebrating their third Bitcoin halving. Doesn't get much more OG than that. So 2011, Bitstamp's been the preferred exchange for serious traders and investors worldwide, with over 4 million customers, including top financial institutions. They've got some serious trading tech, matching engine from NASDAQ, the best APIs in the industry, and TradeView, their advanced trading interface with live charting and deep analytical tools that are available on web and mobile. So you can join the 4 million traders on Bitstamp by downloading their app, the App Store or Google Play, or go to bitstamp.net/pro to get started. And a reminder for Bitstamp users, Messari is now offering 25% off of Messari Pro, our professional analytics toolkit with best-in-class research and advanced tools to help identify your next investments using promo code Bitstamp. That's Messari.io, offer code Bitstamp to get ahead of the crypto curve. This episode of the podcast brought to you by Crypto.com. We know times are tough. That's why Crypto.com is introducing three different measures to help its community with their new Crypto.com app and credit card. First, they're waiving the 3.5% credit card fee on all crypto purchases in the next 3 months. They're also offering 10% back when you use the MCO Visa card on food and grocery shopping. And as always, you can buy gift cards on the Crypto.com app for merchants like Whole Foods, Safeway, Burger King, and more, with 20% back on food and an additional 10% back on groceries. So download the Crypto.com app today.
The second thing is that the line in the sand around decentralization is kind of arbitrary, and it depends on who you're talking to, and people will draw the line in the sand basically right in front of wherever they are. It seems like human nature is kind of like that. So I think it's like
the Craft Brewers Association being owned by Sam Adams. So every year, right, the market share percentage ticks up by like 1 point, right?
Yeah.
Because they keep getting bigger.
No, that's exactly right. And so I think that like we owe it to the community and to the ecosystem to be honest with ourselves and say like, sure, if we are working with a lot of these really great funds and custodians and exchanges and token holders, we can become a point of failure, and we're trying not to do that. And we're doing a bunch of other things outside of that. So things like making sure that we're set up, not just in the United States, but in different regulatory regimes as well. Making sure that we are, you know, not taking on too much of a particular network in the event that we do have some issues. Like, and we've done this in the past where, you know, when the company was a little bit younger, we had a little bit of concern about like, you know, maybe one piece of technology, and we had customers that would put us at a position where we would be running more than F of a network in a Byzantine fault. And we decided to not take those customers on. And we said, we're sorry, we're not going to, because this is too much of a risk for the network itself. And that's bad for us, right? So we also recognize that as participants in the network and trying to be good community members, we need to do a good job. And if we don't do a good job, we're really shooting ourselves in the foot there as well. So, you know, there's a few things that we're working on in that respect. I would say the most important thing is that Bison Trail, and this is something we've voted on in governance proposals. Like, for instance, in the Cosmos network, there was a proposal to do some kind of correlated slashing, where if like more than one validator went down at once, you would get slashed much more. And the idea was like basically stop folks that were doing stuff like us. And we were saying like, look, like that actually helps us, because it hurts someone, you know, much smaller player that's like, you know, running on Amazon, because they only know how to run on Amazon, whereas like we can actually run across like a whole bunch of different providers and we can move things around easier. And so it encourages people to have like professional setups. And we're very open and clear about that. We're like, if you know, this is great for us, don't do it. You know, it's like, and so we're just trying to do our best to help the communities move forward and help them do the right thing. It takes, honestly, like it's weird because we're working in all these different networks that are permissionless and meant to be trustless. But the truth is like, we're actually asking a lot of our customers and the communities to trust us as we continue to build out the technology to make it better. Yep. You know, so it's hard. I will say like the last thing I'll say about it is, I think if you're using Bison Trails and you're using a platform that has, or a platform like Bison Trails, you're using a platform that has a redundancy and availability built into it, you're probably doing a better job than if you're running it on a Raspberry Pi in your dorm room for the network itself. And so that's something, you know, sort of worth considering, like where in the sand are you drawing the line around decentralization?
Yep. Well, let's talk about decentralization then. And you guys have been very high profile. As a supporter of Libra, we talked a little bit about it at the onset there just last week, some changes to the kind of core design principles of the project in which it will be a permissioned system for the foreseeable future. And obviously that's for not a, you know, bait and switch reasons. It's for regulatory reasons and just their ability to actually get this project off the ground. You know, what has been your take on Libra versus other projects? I don't want to go, you know, basically do like, you know, the Tinderization of your entire like ecosystem of supported blockchains, but I feel like we need to do at least one, because sure, Facebook has just unlimited resources compared to the rest of crypto, right? They can fund more engineering than the entire crypto market combined go towards this effort, and they are right. You know, you're talking about just an immense amount of human capital that's getting, you know, put at this project. It is immense in terms of the scale that it could hit if it is allowed to get released and it does live up to some of the early promise. What do you think is misunderstood technically about the Libra project right now in terms of development quality, in terms of speed, in terms of extensibility of the platform, and really how disruptive this could be, even if it's permissioned? And maybe, you know, they would argue in their marketing language, this isn't disruptive. This is like a rising tide thing. But in reality, right, like how much oxygen can they attract here if they're able to get off the ground based on the core product and what's been built so far?
Yeah, so it's an awesome question, because I do think that there's a few pieces, especially around the technology, that are maybe misunderstood or maybe understood by not enough people. And I think the most important thing that Okay, so yes, you're 100% right. Facebook has an immense amount of resources to be able to try and solve some of these problems. And I like the idea that this isn't, we're not framing this as like permissioned versus permissionless, but more like what is actually happening in the technology space around this project that is interesting. And I think for me, one of the most impressive things that's been worked on is Move and the Move VM and the smart contracting language and the way that it's been built. I think Facebook undeniably has made contributions to technology over the last decade that has moved markets, moved entire markets, whether that's mobile, whether it's advertising. And now I think I'm really excited by the technology contribution to the blockchain and crypto space. I think that there's a tremendous amount of talent from Facebook and work that's going into this project. And that to me is like a tide that rises all boats, in a sense that it's setting a bar very, very high from a technical perspective about what it means like to build this kind of a project. Yes, you're 100% right. Like it's not, it's going to be a permission network, and we just announced that. And yes, it's, got like regulatory and compliance sort of connections to it in a sense, like how to launch the project itself. But the technology is really sound, like really, really sound. Like if all we get out of this is Move and the Move VM, I think that the crypto and blockchain space should be very happy because it's quite cool. And there's a few projects that have been working on integrating Move into their projects, into their protocols. And it's not even, technically live yet. So that's been pretty impressive. It's actually not the first thing that Facebook would be open sourcing or anything like that. They've open sourced plenty of stuff, but to get them to open source a blockchain and crypto project and sort of do it in the open and see the code that's happening, the code that's being built and see it live as it's happening, is probably very good for everyone in the crypto and blockchain space as well. So those are the key things. Putting into action publicly another Byzantine fault tolerant consensus network is great. It's great for everybody. One more test case. Right now we have Tezos and Cosmos and Algorand and a couple others. I don't want to name too many and not name other ones, but it's really great to see another one out. Like at the end of the day, like these are still very much in the early experimental phases. Just so to see them out and at scale is huge. The last thing I will say, and this is something that is a little bit less about specifically the technology itself, but one of the things that was super exciting for me to get involved with the Libra project, and there's plenty of things that created pause as well, but one of the things that was super exciting to me was this idea of working on a project that had a different type of distribution channel and distribution method that could be absolutely dwarfing to sort of everything else in the crypto space. And I think that maybe isn't as well understood as it should be. I think people understand like Facebook is big, but the Libra Association actually includes Facebook. It includes, Uber and Lyft. It includes Shopify. And, there's like lots of folks in the association, and it's very, very cool to see the sort of scale that this could be deployed at.
Makes sense. I put myself in the cautiously optimistic camp. I was actually hoping that it would take off as a permissionless system, because I've been pretty outspoken about Libra being an excellent lead blocker for the rest of the crypto industry and our general ability to hide in plain sight. But I think that the coronavirus and macro trends are kind of ruining that anyway.
Yeah, but that can be true too, though.
Sorry for big time.
Mm-hmm. Like Libra can still be a lead blocker for the rest of the crypto space too. They're not mutually.
I think so. Yeah.
Like it doesn't need to be for that to be true.
I think if you just think about like gaming this out, the whole world is distracted by the coronavirus pandemic. The question is ultimately going to be what happens to currencies, emerging market currencies first and foremost, which is where the problems are really going to be.
Yep.
And then will China's digital currency play a role in some of the Southeastern Asian countries, maybe if they have emerging market crises? And then how fast can Libra get out the door? Is that like the Western alternative? All of a sudden, you know, Zuckerberg goes from public enemy number one to like, please release Libra so that we don't lose our reserve status to China. Yeah. And then, you know, all the while you've got, you know, Bitcoin and all these other Web3 systems that get to, you know, basically hide in plain sight for an extended period of time.
Yep.
Whether that comes to fruition it remains to be seen. But I feel like the fact that you do have Libra versus DCEP coming at the same time,
yeah,
it's like everybody's distracted by, you know, the top card. And really, it's just like the heavyweights dancing around each other for 10 rounds and not really throwing any punches. When all the interesting shit is like the welterweights that are just slamming at each other for like the full 15 rounds and going back and forth and actually drawing blood, you know? So, whereas, you know, there's going to be a knockout blow from the heavyweights. And if the US government says no, then it's, you know, okay, there's not much of a match to watch. Right.
That's right.
So,
yeah, that's also a great analogy. I love it. And also, you know, worth highlighting, you know, Bison Trails as a company supports, like you said at the beginning, like 20 plus, I think it's something like close to 25 different protocols in different stages of live, testnet, pre-mainnet, whatever you want to call it. And Libra is one of the protocols we support. You know, it's not, we're sort of thinking about that in a similar fashion, which is like, there's a lot going on here, but there's so much interesting activity happening at the welterweight class. And it's just incredible to be a part of.
You guys running all this infrastructure, just aside from the anecdotal, like we've been talking about with Libra, you have a bunch of hard data on these projects. How have you thought about packaging that? Is it accessible or do you have a sandbox in place where folks can start to query some of these systems? Because, you know, one of the most interesting opportunities, you know, that I would see, you know, as an infrastructure company, maybe, is just converting this into like queryable databases, right? And BigQuery started to do this with the proof of work systems, but there is no such thing for proof of stake systems.
Yeah.
And to a certain extent, that's holding back the overall ecosystem development because, you know, if you're thinking about making a staking decision or investment decision, and you don't know what the inflation rate is or how much money you're going to make or what the network fees are, it can get pretty overwhelming pretty quickly. And unless you're actually running the infrastructure, you don't see it. Is that like a public good, or do you think that there's, you know, something that you'll spin up on the data side in the coming quarters, years?
That's a good question. I think that we know that what you're describing is a problem. I think like what we've recognized, not necessarily a problem, but an interesting opportunity and a challenge for the space, right? The challenge for the space and interesting opportunity for us. I would say I'd probably go back to this idea that we're trying to stay as focused as we possibly can. And I think that, you know, nailing down the infrastructure itself and making sure that these networks are secure, orchestrated, well-deployed, reliable, and safe is an incredibly, incredibly important role that we take very, very seriously. With that, we understand that we also have like data integrity and data security and also data, you know, availability responsibilities. So we're trying to be really careful there in a sense that, like, you know, if you're running a node on using Bison Trails to run a node on a network, like, do you own that data? Is that a public good to the ecosystem because it's on a blockchain? And what is our role play there? And we to be entirely transparent, we haven't figured it out entirely. And that's because we've just been spending all of our time making sure these networks run really, really well. I agree with you that the data piece is important, like and a huge opportunity, and will help the ecosystem, whether that's a product or a public good or, you know, queryable, externally queryable, is really still up in the air. We're not 100% sure. I do know that there are pieces to our product and our platform, things like blockchain reporting, that we offer. That's a big driving point for people using Bison Trails. And it's not an easy problem to solve. All of these different protocols are different. They're nuanced. Understanding how the data is structured, building it in a way that is queryable, and making that accessible to our customers is a non-trivial challenge. And it's something that we're definitely working on and working closely with our customers to figure out, like, help identify, like, what are the things that are most useful, and It would be great to talk to some folks in the ecosystem, different folks in the ecosystem that are interested in that, because it can probably help us do best for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we'll sidebar at the end of this conversation.
Yeah. Let's talk data later.
Yeah. But it's one of the most maddening problems. You know, every single major data vendor has different trading volume numbers, different circulating supply numbers, different staking yield numbers, different interest rate figures. Like it's just complete fucking chaos.
Yeah.
And a lot of the providers that are trying to work on this are, you know, they're good, right? Most of them are competitors, but I think we're all pretty good at just taking different methodologies, which is, yep. And a lot of it's because there are so many edge cases in these new systems. So, you know, final thought on, just trends that you see with some of these, different, you know, Web3 protocols. You must have a much better intuition at this point on teams that will hit their projections in terms of milestones and progress on the development roadmap versus which teams are just chronically missing. And I don't expect you to name names. And by the way, this isn't necessarily an indictment of the quality of the team or how ambitious their vision is, because, you know, you might put someone like, the ETH2 crowd in the Elon Musk camp, where they just have these like wildly ambitious plans, and you know they're consistently coming up short in terms of stated goals, but still making a hell of a lot of progress in the meantime. And then there are much quieter, faster moving protocols that are more like the Steve Jobs camp, where they're just sandbagging the shit out of everything and kind of moving very aggressively. Maybe without naming names and kind of talking about, you know, I don't know if you're comfortable, you know, how do you kind of think about the different teams, how quickly they're moving, versus, you know, how complex their blockchains are. And if you want to pass on that, then, I understand, but I won't appreciate it.
So I won't call out specific projects on either side. What I will do though, is I'll say, yes, we've gotten very good, and it's taken a while, but we've gotten really good at understanding what are some of the key signals to seeing or being able to predict how close a team is to actually getting to where it wants to be or where it's stating it's going to be. That's not an easy thing to do. It does involve being pretty close to the code itself and understanding the code that's being built. But it's not an impossible task. What I will say that there is an undeniable truth about blockchain protocols, and that is the more decentralized and open source and open governance there is, the slower that they move always. That is like a consistent truth. So the smaller the team, the more closed off they are, the more centralized they are, the less external contributors to the code base there is, the faster they move. And that is hands down, every time I've seen that, I've yet to see a more open team move faster than a more closed team. I know it sounds sort of obvious, and I might be just stating the obvious, but that is a truth. So when you take a project like ETH and ETH2 and the community, you know, ETH is you know, incredible as a community and incredible as a developer community, but they've got a lot of governance to deal with, a lot of discussions to have, and a lot of consensus to create within the ecosystem and the community. And then you have a project, you know, like one of these Ethereum friends, like you said, that maybe is just the founding team, and it's just, you know, seven people, and maybe they're venture backed, so they don't have to worry about grants, and maybe they're or they're self-funded because they're really, really successful entrepreneurs from something else. So we've seen kind of the gamut, and those teams tend to move a lot faster. What I will say is that almost every single person we've worked with, every single team we've worked with has missed dates and is late. And that's just the nature of building very ambitious, very hard projects. I've been asked a few times, like, who are some of, like, not even in the context of crypto, but just like, who are some of the most interesting people that like, or people that I admire the most. And I almost always talk about the protocol founders that we work with. They are like crazy ambitious. Sometimes they're thinking through like these insane ideas and they're trying to put bring them to real life all in the public eye. And I'm just like, this is so hard to do. There's definitely like a gamut across the board. We're getting better and better at it. It's one of those things, like I actually would love to, with permission of some of these teams, like at some point maybe talk about or write about. I would never do it with that unless I talk to them about it first.
Yeah, that's a dangerous can of worms that you'd be opening up otherwise.
Well, they're our allies too, right? Like we work, we work great with the protocol teams themselves as well as the funds and the custodian exchanges.
Yeah. It does make intuitive sense that some of the more open teams are moving faster because it's the same way, if you make a public resolution after New Year's, you're more likely to succeed, or like public pronouncement that you're,
is that true?
You're creating a new habit. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Huh, interesting.
Just putting something out there and kind of forcing accountability. You know, this was, ironically, this is how I got into the industry in a roundabout way, because I was in the middle of shutting down my my previous startup and had been through a summer accelerator. And I went to, I think it was HubSpot's conference. HubSpot's marketing, content marketing conference. And there was a speaker that talked about like her weight loss challenge, which was just like taking a sweaty selfie every day. And then she also applied that to like writing. And she's like, instead of just like writing like a couple paragraphs and like keeping it in Evernote or whatever, like the default system was, like push it to Medium or Tumblr or, whatever.
Right.
And tell people about it. So they read it and they make fun of you and you develop a thick skin, and B, you stop caring, and C, you're getting peer review, which most people, like, that's all they want. They want the attention of publishers. And it absolutely is the first thing that I recommend for non-technical people when they get into the space. It's like, you want a job in crypto and you're not technical? Well, you've bet your ass you better develop a public persona and an audience of some kind, because there's just not that many people that are going to be interested.
Yeah.
If you're young, you can't write and you don't code. So you better hop on it. And I'd imagine just in terms of like pace and in terms of staying comfortably uncomfortable, having a set of milestones to march towards and knowing that all of your competitors see that as well, has to be a pretty meaningful forcing function.
Yeah.
My last question, which I just started asking recently, I wish I'd been doing it all along, because I'd be able to actually do the casting. HBO is going to write a series about crypto at some point. You know it's going to happen. You know it's going to be it's either going to be terrible or it's going to be great.
Yeah.
Who in that scenario do you want playing Joe? And cast in that role.
Oh man. Who would I want playing Joe? Is Joe a villain or a hero in this?
This is that, like, the folks in crypto are exponential thinkers, because I just had this conversation with the Bitfinex founder just a little while ago. So both, maybe you can pick one of, each, or you can triangulate in an actor that could go either way.
Let's see. I think, I feel like, it'd have to be like a method, either like a comedian or like a method actor, So like, let's go like, full on Bill Murray, just the
time machine humor. Bill Murray. Yeah.
Exactly. That's who it would be.
Or just him at 70.
Him at 70 would be amazing too.
Yeah.
Like that would be both aspirational for Joe in real life, as well as I think like he could probably play both the balance between a hero and a villain. He could probably do both. And I like to smile a lot and laugh a lot and make other people laugh, and I don't take myself too seriously. So
did you have a second method actor involved?
I was thinking this is influenced because I just rewatched Joker, and I thought that Joaquin Phoenix did this incredible job of towing the line between both a hero and a villain. I mean, I know he's a villain and he's very much a villain, but the way that
how fucking dark do you have to be, man, to be like, oh, he's kind of, I can see him being a hero a little bit, right?
There's this one scene at the end of the movie, which I'm not going to ruin the movie, but there's a scene where he's like standing on a car and he's like kind of like got his arms up in the air and there's people around him cheering and you're like, oh my God, there's like a hero element to this. This movie is so messed up.
Yeah, that's what makes it so dark. Exactly.
Yeah, it's so dark. But, you know, obviously, like, I wish I was complex enough that a method actor like that would have to have to step in. But sadly, Bill Murray would probably do a great job. Bill Murray in Groundhog Day.
That's, you know, that's not a bad life goal. So, yeah. Joe, it's been fun catching up. Excited for everything that's been coming out of Bison Trails. And look forward to more coming out the rest of the year. Where can people find you? And the company on Twitter and the interwebs.
Yeah. Ryan, thanks so much for having me. And obviously this was an absolute blast. I hope it's not the last time we do this. You can find us at bisontrails.co on the internet or at Bison Trails on Twitter. Feel free to reach out. Hi@bisontrails.co or on Twitter. We love when people ask us questions and talk to us. And if you're interested in anything that we do, our services, or knowing more about the protocols we work with, don't be shy.
Excellent. Joe, thank you. And thank you everyone for listening and tuning in for this most recent episode of Unqualified Opinions. We'll be right back in 2 or 4 days, depending on which day of the week this drops. Stay safe, be good. And until next time, peace.
That's a wrap. Thanks for listening. New episodes of Unqualified Opinions go live weekdays at noon Eastern time. You can follow me in the meantime on Twitter at 2BitIdiot. If you want to continue the conversation or troll me, otherwise, I'll see you next week.